He was unique among them in that he worried outwardly about the future, whereas almost everybody else was confident that everything was going to be all right. But Marston, whenever he was feeling downcast, would brood over his wife and children at home. His attitude was not improved by Shackleton's obvious and increasing dislike for him. It was one of those inexplicable things. Perhaps Marston's uneasiness itself was at fault. Shackleton seemed to fear that this attitude would spread to other men. But apart from his changeable nature and the fact that he was not overly eager to turn out for work, Marston was well liked by most. Among the forecastle hands, the seamen and firemen, the only outstanding individual was John Vincent, a young, ambitious bully. He was quite short, but ruggedly built, and much stronger than any of the other seamen, and he sought to use his superior strength to dominate his shipmates by intimidation. He insisted on being served first at mealtimes so that he could pick the best portion, and when grog was issued, he always managed to get more than his share. The other seamen not only disliked him personally, they had very little respect for his abilities aboard ship. Vincent had been in the Navy, but most of his experience at sea had been aboard trawlers in the North Sea. Unlike Howe, Bakewell and MacLeod, who had served for years aboard square riggers, Vincent had had no previous experience in sail. Nevertheless, he had his eye on the vacant post of boatswain, and he felt that the best way to get it was to demonstrate a capacity for tyranny. After a time, the forecastle hands got fed up, and Howe, a soft-spoken, agreeable, and extremely competent little chap, went to Shackleton and complained. Shackleton immediately sent for Vincent. Though it's not known what Shackleton told him, Vincent's attitude was considerably less domineering after that. It was remarkable that there were not more cases of friction among the men, especially after the Antarctic night set in. The gathering darkness and the unpredictable weather limited their activities to an ever-constricting area around the ship. There was very little to occupy them, and they were in closer contact with one another than ever. But instead of getting on each other's nerves, the entire party seemed to become more close-knit. Early in the winter, George Marston and Frank Wilde decided to give each other haircuts. Before they were through, they had shaved off all their hair with the ship's barber clippers. The next evening, the fever had spread throughout the crew. Everyone, including Shackleton, had his hair trimmed down to the scalp. After that, there were many pranks. The following evening, Wilde appeared for supper with his face buried in the neck of his jersey, revealing only the top of his shaved head, on which Marston had painted what Greenstreet described as an imbecilic-looking Johnny. And the next night, Wuzzles Worsley was put on trial for robbing a Presbyterian church of a trouser button out of the offertory bag, and having turned the same to base and ignoble use. The proceedings were long and disorderly. Wilde was the judge, James the prosecuting attorney, and Aud Lees the defense attorney. Greenstreet and McElroy gave testimony against the defendant, but when Worsley promised to buy the judge a drink after the trial, Wilde charged the jury to find the defendant innocent. Nevertheless, Worsley was found guilty on the first ballot. Besides these spontaneous affairs, there was a regular series of social occasions. Each Saturday night before the men turned in, a ration of grog was issued to all hands, followed by the toast to our sweethearts and wives. Invariably, a chorus of voices added, "May they never meet." On Sunday evenings, the men listened to music from the hand-crank phonograph for an hour or two as they lay in their bunks or wrote up their diaries. But the playing of the phonograph was limited because of a shortage of needles. 5,000 had been ordered in England, but Wilde, in sending off the requisition, had failed to specify the word gramophone. Only long after the ship had sailed did Aud Lees, the storekeeper, discover they had 5,000 extra sewing needles and only a small package of the phonograph variety. Then, once each month, all hands gathered in the Ritz, and Frank Hurley, the photographer, delivered a lantern chat, a slide-illustrated lecture on the places he had visited: Australia, New Zealand, the Mawson expedition. The favourite was one called Peeps in Java, which featured waving palm trees and native maidens. The Ritz, on nights like these, was a cosy place. It had been a cargo area just below the main deck and aft of the crew's quarters in the forecastle. Then the stores and men traded places. The supplies were moved to the wardroom area in the deckhouse, and the men took over the hold. The area was about 35 feet long and 25 feet wide, and McNeish had erected partitions to form individual sleeping cubicles for the officers and scientists. In the center was a long table with a paraffin-burning lamp overhead. Here they ate their meals, wrote their diaries, played cards, and read. In one corner was a coal-burning stove which kept the temperature inside quite comfortable. The Endurance's thick sides were excellent insulation. Outside, however, the weather was getting steadily worse. Late in May, the temperature dropped below zero and stayed there. During the first half of June, the average reading was minus 17 degrees. But the scene from the deck of the Endurance was often fantastically beautiful. In clear weather, if the moon was out, it swept in bold, high circles through the starlit skies for days on end, casting a soft, pale light over the floes. At other times, there were breathtaking displays of the Aurora Australis, the Antarctic equivalent of the Northern Lights. Incredible sunbursts of green and blue and silver shot up from the horizon into the blue-black sky, shimmering, iridescent colors that glinted off the rock-hard ice below. But apart from the increasing cold, the weather remained remarkably stable and free from gales. Toward the middle of June, at the blackest part of the winter, a chance boast by Frank Hurley that he had the fastest team resulted in a dog derby. Even at high noon, when the race was run, it was so dark out that the spectators at this Antarctic sweepstakes couldn't see the far end of the racecourse. Wilde's team won, but Hurley claimed that he was carrying more weight than Wilde and demanded a rematch. He later won when Shackleton, who was riding as passenger on Wilde's sledge, slipped off going round a turn, and Wilde was disqualified. The following night, cagey Dr. McElroy brought to light a pair of dice he happened to find among his things. He first shook with Greenstreet to see who would buy champagne when they got home. Greenstreet lost. By that time, several men had gathered round the table in the Ritz, and in subsequent rolls of the dice, an entire evening's entertainment was wagered. Wilde got stuck for buying the dinner. McElroy himself lost the roll for the theatre tickets. Hurley, the after-theatre supper, and parsimonious Jock Wordy, the geologist, was committed to pay for the taxis home. They held a special celebration on Midwinter's Day, June 22nd. The Ritz was decked out with bunting and flags, and Hurley built a stage of sorts, which was lighted by a row of acetylene gas footlights. Everyone gathered for the festivities at 8 p.m. Shackleton, as chairman, introduced the participants. Aud Lees, the storekeeper, was dressed as a Methodist minister, the Reverend Bubbling Love, and he exhorted his listeners against the wages of sin. James, as Herr Professor von Schopenbaum, delivered a lengthy lecture on the calorie. Macklin recited a tropical verse he had written about Captain Eno, the effervescent seafarer, who could have been no one but the effervescent Worsley. Greenstreet described the evening in his diary. "I think I laughed most over Kerr, who dressed up as a tramp and sang Spagoni the Toreador. He started several keys too high, and notwithstanding the accompanist, Hussey, who was vainly whispering lower, lower, and playing in a much lower key, he kept going until he lost the tune altogether. When he came to the word Spagoni, he had forgotten the word, so came out with Stuberski the Toreador, and had completely forgotten the chorus, so simply saying, he shall die, he shall die, he shall die. It was killing, and we laughed until the tears ran down our cheeks. McElroy, dressed up as a Spanish girl, and a very wicked-looking one at that, with very low evening dress and slit skirt showing a bare leg above her stocking tops, gave the Danse Espagnole. Marston sang, Wilde recited The Wreck of the Hesperus, Hudson was a half-caste girl, Greenstreet was a red-nosed drunk, and Rickinson was a London streetwalker. The evening ended at midnight with a cold supper and a toast. Then everyone sang, God Save the King. And so the winter was half done. Chapter 6. The men's thoughts began to turn to spring, the return of the sun and warmth, when the Endurance would break out of her icy prison and they could make a new assault on Vassal Bay. Only once in the last part of June did they hear any sounds of pressure. That was on the 28th, and Worsley described it in his diary. At times during the night, a distant rich booming note is heard, changing at times to a long creaking groan, which seems to carry a menacing tone. It starts up gradually but stops abruptly, and sounds best in the distance. The greater the distance, the better the sound. But then on July the 9th, the barometer began to fall. Very, very slowly. For 5 consecutive days, the reading slid downward. 29.79, 29.61, 29.48, 29.39, 29.25. On the morning of July the 14th, the bottom fell out of the glass. 28.88. An ominous gloom came on about noon. The wind backed to the southwest and began to blow, though not much at first. It wasn't until 7 p.m. that the snow began to fall. By 2 o'clock the following morning, the whole ship vibrated as the wind screamed through the rigging at 70 miles an hour. The snow was like a sandstorm blown up from the pole. Nothing could keep it out, though they lashed tarpaulins over the hatches trying to seal them off. By noon it was impossible to see much more than half the length of the ship. The temperature was 34 degrees below zero. Shackleton ordered that no man venture farther than the dog kennels, which were only a few feet from the ship. The men who fed the dogs had to crawl on their hands and knees to keep from being blown away. Within 2 minutes after leaving the ship, the blinding, suffocating snow blocked their eyes and mouths. On the Endurance's lee side, the force of the wind eroded the ice, leaving it grooved and channeled. On the windward side, snow drifts 14 feet high built up, weighing probably 100 tons overall. The floes alongside the ship bent downwards under the weight of it, and the ship itself, with the load she was carrying, sank a foot. On the following day, the temperature dropped to minus 35 degrees, and the dogs were fed a 1/2 pound of lard each to help them ward off the cold. After breakfast, Shackleton ordered all hands onto the ice to try to clear the floes on the port side of snow. The area around the kennels was becoming dangerously weighted down, and he feared it might buckle under, carrying the dogs with it. All that night, the blizzard raged. But on July the 16th, the snow began to thin out, and by early morning there were patches of clear sky overhead. In the faint glow of light at noon, newly created pressure ridges could be seen in every direction. They looked like hedgerows separating different fields of ice. Against these, banks of snow had drifted, but otherwise the howling wind had blown the surface of the ice free from snow and polished it smooth. Before the storm, the pack had been almost one solid mass of ice, but now it was broken into pieces, and there was an area of open water to the north. It was a situation that made pressure inevitable. The ice, now that it was twisted and broken up, provided 10 million new surfaces to catch the wind, and each floe was capable of moving independent of the rest. The pack would move with the wind, and a kind of behemothic momentum would set up through the ice. The resulting force is called pressure, and it began on July the 21st. Not against the ship herself, for she was in the centre of a thick, tough floe, but there were sounds of ice working toward the south and southwest. The noise continued all night and into the next morning. After lunch, Worsley decided to have a look around. He put on his knitted helmet and watch coat and climbed the ladder. Almost immediately he returned with the news that their floe had cracked. There was a rush to grab Burberries and helmets, and everyone dashed on deck. The crack was there, about 2 feet wide, running from the outer edge of the floe, where extreme pressure had jumbled one slab on top of another to within about 40 yards of the Endurance's port quarter. The sledges were immediately brought on board, and the sea watches set. A breakup seemed imminent. They waited all that day, and into the night, and all the next day. No breakup occurred. The pressure could be heard all around, and occasionally they felt a heavy shock transmitted through the ice. But still the Endurance remained locked in the unbroken center of the floe. The crack on the port quarter froze over. And as the days wore on without any significant change in their situation, the sense of expectancy diminished. The sea watches were cancelled, and sledging practice was resumed on a limited scale.